Now, as you flip open to Exodus chapter 1, I want to give us a little bit of a recap of what's going on here. And Exodus is the story how God delivered his people Israel from their slavery, their bitter, ruthless slavery in the land of Egypt. And it is an incredible story. In fact, it's more than just a story. It is history, and the history of God and his people, a look back at what God has done. But as we go through this book, as I mentioned before, we are also going to get a preview of what God would do and what he still is going to do for us as he gives us a much greater deliverance from a much greater enemy for all nations of this world. And so this story, even though it's an Old Testament story, points us at every single page to the salvation that we have in Jesus Christ. And I am beyond excited for us to discover together how God's love and power and promise are always present with his people as we hear this story together. And so we're going to start at Exodus 1, verse 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. And we'll pause there. So how did we get here to this point in the story? At the end of the book of Genesis, the first book in the Bible, a man named Joseph was born as one of 12 brothers, and he was given a gift by God of having special dreams that meant something. But he was also given the gift of interpreting those dreams. And he became his father's favorite, and his brothers began to despise him, and they sold him into slavery. And it was a whole mess. But while he was in that slavery in Egypt, God used those gifts that Joseph was given to save the nation of Egypt. He warned the leadership of a time of prosperity, but then a time of great famine that would afflict the land. And under Joseph's leadership, he was able to lead through that season of growth and the season of famine and spare all of Egypt. And through that, he earned favor with the Egyptians. And then that famine hit. Everybody was in trouble. But Joseph's family was allowed to come to Egypt. And so because of this, they were all saved. Their children were saved. And even though Joseph and his brothers and that whole generation passed away, once they were in Egypt, they were fruitful. They multiplied. And it says in the scripture here that the land was filled with them. The original Hebrew says they swarmed the land like locusts. There were many, many, many of them. And so there is salvation for God's people through the gifts of Joseph, and they multiplied, and they're in this land, and that sounds really, really nice until it isn't nice anymore. And we continue in verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies, and they fight against us, and they escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens, and they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. All right, there's a new sheriff in town. Transitions can be difficult, can't they? And this new king, this Pharaoh, has no idea who Joseph is. And that doesn't mean that he didn't personally know him. A few hundred years have gone by since the days of Joseph and this new Pharaoh. And he had no idea who Joseph was. He didn't remember, like his ancestors did, the work that Joseph did or how blessed the Hebrew people are. He didn't know any of this. Not even the Hebrew people really knew who Joseph was. They didn't really even know who God was anymore. They were just a people, the Hebrews, which back in the day is kind of the equivalent of calling someone a gypsy, right? They were these people who were not in their own land. They were kind of sojourners, and they were here, but they didn't really belong here. So nobody really knows all of the history. Nobody really knows who the God of Israel is, but all this Pharaoh sees at the moment is a potential uprising, right? He's new, he's the king now, he's a young hotshot, and he is very, very worried about his image, about his prosperity, the prosperity of the nation, and the power that he has, he wants to grip and hold on to and increase, and any potential threats he sees, he wants to deal with immediately. So when he sees these Hebrew people, he sees an uprising, a threat to his kingdom and to his rule, and he feels that the more they become and the more powerful they get, he will eventually lose that power and he will stop owning them as they rise up. And so he has an idea. Hey, why not kill two birds with one stone? If only on the one hand there was a way to keep their population down and weaken them as a people while also driving up the prosperity of Egypt and the success that they enjoy under my new leadership. And of course, there is one solution that works great for both of these, and it's slavery. These are not my opinions, and that's not my conclusion. I want to be very clear about that. This is what the Pharaoh says. Why don't we just make them all slaves? And he did. And it worked. Kind of. Slavery was so successful, so profitable, that they made the slaves who worked in the fields, they worked making bricks, and they were growing, they were selling, they were building. Everything was so prosperous at a very cheap cost to the Egyptians, the money just came and came and came. They had to build two cities that were designated as storage cities. And if you can imagine a city that purely functions as a storage unit for all of the extra stuff that you have amassed, grain storage for food, storage for weapons, storage for treasure, all sorts of things, just the overflow, the excess wealth of the kingdom of Egypt. They were so prosperous through these slaves that they had to build two of those, which were also built by the slaves. So that worked. The nation was prosperous, but it did not keep their numbers down. Look at verse 12 and forward. But the more the Hebrews were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Even as slaves, God has promised to make Israel a great nation. That was the promise that he gave to Abraham. Your descendants will be a great nation. All the world will be blessed. And so God, even in the slavery of the people of Israel, blesses them by making them fruitful and multiplying them. And as that happens, Pharaoh is even more afraid. And so what he does is, well, maybe if I impose more work, harder work on them, that will finally start to crush them. But still, they kept multiplying. And this happened over and over and over, where they would get into this cycle of fear and intimidation by the Egyptians, and they would impose harsher, harder work, but then they would only multiply more and more, which drives up the fear, which drives up the work, which makes them multiply even more and more and more. And the cycle continues. And what we end up with now in Egypt is a very, very large population of Hebrews who have also become bitterly enslaved with back-breaking, spirit-crushing work. Did you catch from the reading how ruthless the Egyptians were. It only mentions it 5 or 6 times in 3 sentences, right? But it was bitter, it was ruthless, it was horrible. But it still did not work. So Pharaoh is more paranoid than ever that the Hebrews are going to jeopardize this whole operation if they get smart, if they rise up, and if they escape. And so he starts to command the unthinkable. He would crush the Hebrews physically, he would crush them in spirit, but he would also crush them by committing genocide. First, he tries to do it in secret, starting at verse 15. The king of the Egyptians said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the male children live. But what a horrible charge that is. What a cowardly act from somebody who's supposed to be the most supreme leader in a country. The cruel Pharaoh orders the midwives to kill the very precious little children that they were meant to keep safe as part of their calling. So of course, and thank God, the midwives disobey. And they cover it up with a lie in verse 18. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Now again, what the midwives had said is a lie. Oh, well, you know, these Hebrew women, they're something else. They are not like these Egyptian women that you have. They give birth so fast. I mean, they are vigorous. They are sturdy women. Before the midwives can even get to their houses, it's done. I say this all the time, but I just want to reiterate this. I'm not a woman. And I never claim to be a woman and know your experiences. But, ladies, I have heard many of your stories of delivering children. And there's two sides of that coin that almost every woman shares with me. Giving birth to my children was the best thing that ever happened to me. Well, let's flip to the other side of that coin real quick, where we get to the, you know, giving birth was like the worst thing that ever happened to me. It was so hard. It was so awful. And I truly do believe that if a woman had any say into how quickly she could give birth, I would not be hearing all of these stories of, yeah, I was in labor for 8 hours. I was in labor for 15 hours. I was in labor for 24 hours. I think I've met somebody who was in labor for 2 or 3 days, right? If you had any say in it, I'm sure not even these Hebrew women can control the pace of their own births. So they lie. And whether Pharaoh has caught on to the lie or not, he knows the plan is not working. He gets more scared. He gets more paranoid. He's frustrated. And now he publicly orders the execution of all Hebrews who are born male. Verse 22, Pharaoh commanded all his people, not just the midwives, not in secret, all of his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. Any one of you, if you see a Hebrew-born male, throw them into the Nile. Now, we'll get to this much later, right? But the Nile, this water, this source of life for the Egyptians, is now meant as an instrument of death for the Hebrews. And we'll find much later in the story that it is by water that the Hebrews will be delivered and the Egyptians will be crushed. It is a beautiful piece of irony, but for now, Pharaoh means only evil through this. So things are not looking good for God's people, are they? The land that provided them food and safety had since become a miserable prison. And they were a broken, suffering, oppressed people who had no land of their own. They had no justice and they had no help. So the big question is, where is God? We get a little mention of him, right? He blessed the midwives, and if you're a midwife, good for you. He increased the population, and that's nice. But what about the things that are not going so well? Where is God in that? And what is he going to do about all of this? Well, to the suffering people, God seemed silent. But now we see a little sign of hope. And we begin in chapter 2, verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. And the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. And she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the river bank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. So in all of this grand scheme, horrible thing that is happening, in chapter 2, we zoom in on one little family, on just one household, a man and his wife who are from the tribe of Levi. And during the time of Pharaoh's horrible decree, imagine you are that family, you are that couple. You have to be worried the whole time that you're pregnant. What's going to happen to this child? Perhaps even praying, God, please do not let this be a boy. But when the child is born, he is. And the mother saw something in him. The Old Testament says that he was a fine child. The New Testament in Hebrew says beautiful. What we get from the language that's used here is that he was good. It was very good, in the same way that when God made the world, it was good. There was something about this child that even beyond a mother looking at her newborn in that maternal love, she could see something. There's something about him. He's not like the rest. Something is going on here, and no matter what happens, the Egyptians cannot get him. So she hides him for 3 months. She nurses him, she raises him up, she loves him. But after 3 months, she realizes we can't hide him any longer. The Egyptians are going to find him, and they have no way to protect him from the Egyptians. And so as a very last resort, she puts everything in God's hands. She makes a little boat. She makes an ark for him out of reeds, out of tar, and she places the basket safely on the river in the reeds that are growing in the water. She would hope then that somehow, she doesn't know how, she doesn't know if or when, that this beautiful, good child would escape this horrible mess that God's people are in. And after she places him in the reeds, his little sister stays behind, and she watches. She wants to know what's going to happen to her little brother. And as she watches, an Egyptian woman comes to the river, and she finds the child in verse 5. Now, not just any Egyptian woman, the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew children." Pause here and notice that no one is as cruel as the Pharaoh. Even his daughter, who can only gain from his prosperity, sees a little child and has pity on him. And as this is happening, Moses' sister, Miriam, she's still hiding in the bushes, and she comes out and she has this very risky but genius idea. Look at what she says, verse 7. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Well, shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse this child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When he grew stronger, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, because, she said, I drew him out of the water. Did you catch what's happening here? Within the span of a day, Moses' mother went from losing her son to death to coming up with this plan in which she would still never see her son again, to now being able to raise her son, because Moses' sister said, let me get some random Hebrew for you. She can nurse him. And she goes right back home and says, Mom, psst, Mom, look what happened. She calls her own mother. To now, Moses' mother gets to raise him, and I don't know if you caught this, she's getting a stipend for it now. She's getting paid to raise her own child in her own house, which is incredible. And the child is named Moses. It's the Hebrew word to draw water out of a river, out of a well. I drew him out of the water. Now, if we zoom back out to this whole story, I cannot imagine being a Hebrew person during the reign of this new Pharaoh. It is pretty commonly known that this time that we are alive right now is the easiest time ever to be alive. In our place, in our setting, in our time, us right here, we live in the, if not one of the most developed nations. We have safety nets like health insurance. We have, you know, this government establishments that are rigid and protect the people. We have a functioning society. We don't have any active oppression. Everything is so well. The conveniences and the riches that we have, it is unparalleled in any other place or time in this world. But these Hebrew people don't live in our time. And I can't imagine living as them in the time of this new Pharaoh, who are suffering ruthless, back-breaking, crushing work with no rest and no mercy, where the point of the work is to crush them. It's not a side effect, it's the point. They're being treated like animals whose life only exists for the purpose of making a profit for others. And they are living under the constant terror of themselves being crushed and losing their children and their families. I wouldn't last a day underneath all of this. But as all of this is happening, as we read this story, as so often is in the Bible, you and I, we get to take a peek behind the curtain of the stage and the theater and the play that is happening at the moment. But at this time, God's people don't get the peek behind the curtain. All they get to see is the here and the now and the suffering. And if I were them, I would have that same very big question that they must be asking. Where is God? Why did he allow all of this? And does he not have the power to just stop Pharaoh? I mean, this is the mighty God of Israel. He could just strike him down as soon as there's a threat against his people, but he doesn't. And does he see us suffering bitterly? And if he does see us, does he care? And why did he bring us into Egypt if he knew that this was going to be our fate? And what about the promise that he made to our father Abraham, that we would be a nation, yeah, but we would be a nation in our own land where he would watch over us? What is going on? If I were a Hebrew, I would be tired. I would be depressed. I would be very confused at my very core, confused, and I would be hopeless. And I'm not even suffering what they're suffering, but I still feel those things sometimes. As cushy as my life is, as nice as existence is in our place and in our time, I do. And I ask God those same questions. Maybe I don't look like it, maybe we don't think about it too much, but there's a fair share amount of suffering in my life. There's a fair share amount of sadness and grief and worry. And I know that it is in yours as well. We're not that different. We're all just people. But I ask God those same questions. You know me. You see me. You see what's happening. You said I'm yours. Why did this happen? Why did you let it happen? I know you see my suffering, but I want to know, God, do you care? The way that the scriptures have said, the way the pastors have told me, the way that the songs have reminded me, do you care? And what about the promises that you've made to me? Because I can't see them being fulfilled at the moment. And there's so much that hurts. There really is. There's so much that causes grief. There's so much that weighs on us in this life. We're not that different from the Egyptians, right? Different place, different time, different severity. But we still worry about oppression. We worry about the world. We worry about society. We worry about how our family is going to be, if our family is going to be. We worry about all kinds of things. It weighs on us in this life. And it's easy to look at our circumstances around us and see all that is against us. But today we get to see that God is not always obvious, nor does he share everything with us in real time. But that doesn't mean that he isn't working. Let's go all the way back to Joseph. Joseph was sold into slavery by his own brothers. He didn't do anything. God gave him these gifts. You know, he was studying under his father. He was doing a good job. He didn't deserve what happened to him. God allowed Joseph to experience this. Joseph's brothers, what they were doing, they meant to do evil. It was purposeful. They knew what they were doing. But Joseph says to them, as they come to Egypt, as he forgives them, they're weeping at his feet. And he says, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. Can you imagine Joseph after experiencing everything, being betrayed by his brothers, being shipped to a different country, enduring all of this, even when he's in Egypt, being thrown in prison, being accused by the wife of his master, horrible things. And at the end of his life, when all this is done, he goes, you know what? God really did do something good here, didn't he? Then while they were in Egypt, God kept his people safe. Safe from the famine, safe for hundreds of years as they resided in an established, protected nation whose leadership favored them, where he made them multiply and he kept his promise to raise them up as the children of Abraham and create a great nation. And now, as an evil Pharaoh mistreats them and plots to kill them, God uses those evil plans to raise up a leader for his people who would take this nation that he has allowed to grow during this time, and it gets so big and so big that it's becoming a problem, and that exact that same moment, he raises up the leader who was going to, when the time is right, lead this big, huge nation out of their slavery and into their own land that God has promised. So in the moment, in time, for these Hebrew people, life is miserable. It is horrible. And we should not say to them, hey man, look at the big picture. It's not that bad. No, it's really bad. But it's going to be good. Even within the span of a generation, as soon as the Pharaoh steps up, the first one who doesn't know Joseph, God immediately starts moving. Maybe not in the time that we like, but in his time. But we finally start to see here, even in this beginning part of the story, that God is not idle. God is not uncaring, and God is not distant ever. And even though their present circumstances and our present circumstances may be rough, we have to remember this. Take a look at what Paul writes in the New Testament in the book of Romans. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. We hear this as a cliche all the time, and unfortunately, it is used as a cliche all the time. God has a master plan, right? Oh, bad thing happens. Oh, God's plan, God's plan. You lost somebody that you love. God's plan. Something's a threat in society. God's plan, God's plan, God's plan. I honestly am pretty sick of hearing God's plan when it's used incorrectly, right? But God does have a master plan. And when we don't view it as a cliche, it is the biggest hope that we can anchor our very souls to. And whatever God has planned, that's how it's going to go. But God doesn't plan and promise to take away all of our pain and all of our suffering. In fact, God promises that he is going to grow and mature us through pain and suffering. He doesn't promise to get rid of all of our circumstances and all of our hardships and just kind of like a plow in front of us clearing the pathway. That's not how it works. God doesn't promise to smite down anyone who dares even look at us the wrong way, who might even think about hurting us in some way. That's not it. In fact, God tells us that at times, he's actually going to lead us as his people into difficult times, into suffering, into spiritual confrontations, harsh circumstances, and things that we just have to endure. But he also promises us that when he does this, that he is going to be there with us, and that it's all going to be part of the ultimate good that he's doing. So just like the Hebrews, in our present day here and now in your life, with your circumstances, with your suffering, with your confusion about why is God allowing this? Why won't he stop it? What is he going to do? I know you can't see it. We don't get the peek behind the curtain. We don't get an explanation. We don't get a reason in real time. Nor do we get a timeline of how everything is going to happen. But all we get for now is a promise that in the end, all of it, the good and the bad, the joy and the pain, the ease and the difficulty, the celebrating, the suffering, all of it is ultimately going to lead to the good that God has planned for his people. Because he is at work in all things. He works in the good, he works in the evil. Nothing will stand against him and what he is doing. We have a promise that while these enemies and all these circumstances who are present in our lives seem to be crushing us and defeating us and conquering over us, God assures us that we don't wish for victory, but we already have the final victory that Jesus Christ has won for us. Take a look at what he continues to say. No, in all of these things, we are more than conquerors through Jesus Christ who loved us. For I am sure, and you can put any of your circumstances in here right now. I'll put in a little blank for you. That neither death nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation, nor the blanks in your life will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. You have a God who is present, who is caring, who is active, who is not always obvious, but he is with you. And this will all lead to good, even if it's not all good right now. And so when God seems absent, it's not because he is absent, it's because of our perception of his absence. The thing that we need to do, which sounds counterintuitive, right? When God seems like he's absent, you need to go to him even more. Pray to him. Seek refuge in him. Trust in him. And anchor yourself to the promises that he's made rather than the things that you see in front of you right now. And I know there are things that you want. I know you want him to do this and that and wrap it up, but whatever God is doing is better than anything that you can imagine. And whatever he's doing is worth what you're going through. And I know how that sounds, and I don't want to be dismissive. What he's doing is worth what you're going through. And what he is doing will only be for good in the end. And one day you will see that yourself. But for now, you just have to trust. And this is our word from God for today.